welcome to the finding episode of Trailblazing Leaders of Tomorrow Series 1. I'm your host for today, Mike Gage, and I'm thrilled to be here for my first time hosting this fantastic series. For those who don't know me, I'm a legal and governance advisor at the Black Policy Institute, where I normally work on shaping policies that promote equality and justice, principles that we've celebrated throughout this podcast series. I've had the honour of witnessing this incredible work that this platform has brought to life, celebrating leaders who are truly shaping the future. But before we get into today's incredible interview, I'm joined by a familiar face you've heard throughout this journey, Elijah Moko, co-host and brilliant mind behind many of the conversations we've had here. Elijah, how is it going?
Do you know what? I'm feeling quite good. Like, we've got an absolutely special guest in the house tonight, and I'm quite excited for this one. And obviously, it being the last episode, we've definitely got to go out with a bang. So 100%. I'm absolutely feeling the energy.
No, we really saved something special for this final episode.
So today we are joined by none other than Stephen Akinsanya.
Hello.
Hi. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but you, sir, have been a barrister for the past 29 years in private
it's
practice.
It's actually going to be 31.
31!
Yes, coming up.
Congratulations, yeah. Sir. That is a true, true achievement. How are you feeling?
Slightly older, a little wiser, but pleased to be here. Still be here.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah.
Pleased to have you, and I would argue you don't look a day over 24. So that's all that matters.
Flattery will get you everywhere.
I'm hoping so.
If you don't mind, just give you a little introduction. Stephen specializes in complex and serious criminal cases, including financial crime and murder, and has tackled some of the most high-profile cases both here in the UK and abroad, including a three-year stint as a senior attorney in the Turks and Caicos Islands. How was it doing practicing abroad?
Wonderful. It was a great opportunity. It was almost a surreal moment of waking up in the morning and looking out of the window and seeing the sea and the beach and then going for a walk along the beach and still being in time for court, no commuting. Wow. And sometimes flying to court in a propeller plane.
Really?
Between islands. Yeah, it was incredible.
That must have been an experience.
Yeah, a real experience. Life.
Yeah, I'll never forget it. It was just unbelievable when I boarded the plane and the captain said, no, come and sit next to me. I was like, oh, really?
I'm not saying no. You know, I'd be there. Yeah. I think what's really impressive about your career, especially to me personally, is the fact that, yes, you have this amazing professional background, you know, 31 years of service. That's great. But you've also taken the time to make sure you lift as you climb and, you know, you've been very specific and passionate about addressing, you know, youth violence, knife crime, and kind of actively educating young people about the criminal justice system and how it works and how they fit into it. Mm. And, you know, as someone who is a young black male, that really resonates with me. You know, I've not been in my service for 31 years. I've only been in it for just under two, but like, it really provides inspiration for the kind of career I would like to have. Not in law, I must admit, though.
That's okay.
No, and as an aspiring barrister, it's amazing to have someone like you here to hear your experiences and stories.
Oh, thank you again for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
No, excellent. Well, we're really excited to dive into your journey. So let me start with this one. With over 30 years of experience, as you were saying, what first inspired you to pursue a career as a barrister? Was there
okay?
Like,
well, I've got to take you back to the early mid 70s.
Oh, I've heard about this.
And believe it or not, we weren't in horse and cart. There were cars, and there was color television. Although we only had four channels, but I was a young boy who was inspired by a television program called Crown Court. And this was a program on at lunchtimes, and it serialized basically the courtroom with courtroom dramas, courtroom cases with barristers, judges, defendants. And I remember watching it thinking, wow, I love the eloquence with which these people speak. And of course, I saw the wig for the first time and the gown. And I thought, oh, I think I could do this. I'd be interested in this. I just loved the drama of the courtroom. Yeah. And so that was my first sort of inspiration. And then in those days, we had to go to the library. If you wanted to find anything out, you couldn't go on the internet. There was no internet.
Yeah, of course.
So you literally had to go to the library. And I remember going to my local library in Croydon, where I grew up, a place called Thornton Heath. And going to this library and picking up this book about the Old Bailey and famous murders. And I was fascinated to find out about these people who had been on trial, why they had done what they had done, the drama of the courtroom. And I remember sitting in my room reading it, and my dad finding the book and going crazy, thinking, oh no, what's my son reading?
What's he getting into?
But that was actually my introduction to an interest in criminal law and becoming a barrister. So I think I was about 10 or 11 years old.
Wow, that's amazing. Early age to have such an inspiring premonition. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
That is very insightful. And then I guess kind of flipping it back to now, obviously having, you know, like you said, worked for 31 years in the industry, what would you say has been one of the most kind of profound moments or cases, obviously, you know? Like what would you say has been a moment that you would say you would never forget, whether that's positive or negative, emotional or not?
Well, as you can imagine, after all these years, I've done literally, I think, thousands of cases. But there was always one that haunted me because of, you know, when I'm asked the question, oh, how do you defend people when you know they're guilty? That's the number one question that I get asked at a party. And I say, well, I don't know that people are guilty. I'm given a case and I don't really form a view. I just do the job. But in this particular case, the evidence was so sort of overwhelming that in my normal self, without my wig and gown, I formed a view that this guy was guilty. And it was a horrible murder in the Turks and Caicos Islands, of all places. And I knew he did it, but I was professionally duty-bound to represent him. And I found a technicality in the law which meant that if I didn't argue it, he would go to trial, and I would be failing in my duty. And I argued the case before we even got to call a witness or anyone, and he got off the murder on a technicality. And they literally had to change the law as a result of that case. But for years, it haunted me because he literally got away with murdering a young woman. And then I heard about 6 years later that he'd actually murdered somebody else.
Oh, wow.
And so I had to live with that because in my sort of subconscious, it was, oh, you're responsible. It's your fault that he got away with it. But I was just acting professionally, challenging the law, which is what we're called to do.
Of course.
You're doing your job.
Lawyer. Yeah.
You're doing your job.
So that's the case that really, really sticks out. I mean, there have been other great cases that I've done. In fact, another case I could quickly share with you. I sort of claim responsibility for introducing online hearings because I was involved in a court case where I had no option but to call this witness who was in Cyprus, and I had to think quickly on my feet. And I said to the judge, can I use my iPad to call this witness? And I remember standing in front of the jury box with my iPad, with a witness being sworn, and then giving their evidence with me holding my iPad. And that was the first court case that I can remember where a lawyer used their iPad in a criminal trial. And I remember writing an article thanking Steve Jobs for the invention of the iPad. And thereafter, online hearings were born.
That's incredible.
Wow. I didn't realize you'd been setting trends like that.
I didn't know.
Such an impact.
Yeah, it was a great case. Yeah.
Wow. Can I ask as well, on the topic of the Turks and Caicos case, how do you reconcile with your cases after you know someone might have been guilty, or, you know, you go on to find that they might have committed crimes afterwards?
Well, first of all, I recognize my role within a criminal justice system that I operate in. I can only be one thing. I cannot be judge. I can't be the jury. I can't be the prosecutor and also be the defense lawyer. So I've selected the role that I want to play within that system, which is to defend. Once I've done my job professionally and honorably, then I take a view that ultimate judgment comes from our creator. So it's a faith thing. So I don't lose too much sleep in the fact that once I've done everything that I can do and I've not broken any rules doing it, then the ultimate judgment for everybody comes from the creator. And so that way I can sleep. Otherwise, I'd go mad. Mm. Of course, I listen to a lot of music and I switch off when I'm not in court. But that's how I cope with it.
Oh, sounds kind of healing.
Yeah, yes. Definitely.
I guess spiritually so, but also like emotionally, just being able to kind of tie up, not loose ends, but like kind of have that full circle moment. And I guess you know, I work in the civil service, and I know exactly what you mean about playing your part of a bigger operation.
Absolutely.
Sometimes these things is actually bigger than you. It's bigger than me. Yeah. It's bigger than us all, and it requires someone with a lot more authority, whether that be, you know, for me, it would be like a government minister, but I like the fact that for you, it's a higher power, literally.
No, 100%.
And so I guess my question would be, you know, looking at your career and the different areas that you've kind of touched, criminal law, international arbitration, and so much more, how do you feel about your ability to develop a proficiency in such a broad and diverse kind of set of areas? Because, I mean, I don't know that to be common. Is that common with barristers? I don't know that to be common.
It's less common the more senior you become, because you become entrenched in what you're doing. And so it's difficult then to develop a discipline in another field of law. And for me, I love learning. I'm constantly learning, not just within the field of criminal law, but I like to challenge myself. So the arbitration that you mentioned came about actually as a result of the lockdown. Because during that time, we couldn't go to court. Because of the risks. And so I had an option. I could just sit at home watching Netflix, sitting on the sofa, or I could try some gardening. But I thought, you know what? No, I'm going to go back to school. So I enrolled at Queen Mary University to do a master's program in international dispute resolution, because I was interested in arbitration as the alternative to what we call adversarial advocacy. Is slightly different from being in front of a judge and a jury with a prosecution. It's slightly different. And I was interested in that. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to go back and I'm going to do this master's program at the grand old age of 55. And I did it. And so it was a challenge to me. And there was birthed this real interest in arbitration. And so I've been developing that as an alternative, or running alongside my criminal law practice.
Wow, that's very impressive.
It really goes to show that no matter how far in your career you are, you really do never stop learning.
Yeah. Never stop learning.
You're never done. 100%. I don't know if that's... that for me, that's like really impressive on one hand, but slightly daunting, I guess, on the other hand. Someone who's
Those late nights were daunting, I tell you what. But it was worth it. And I always say to young people that I mentor, you know, you never stop learning. And anyone who thinks they've got it all sussed and they've learnt all there is to learn in a particular profession, they're kidding themselves. For as long as we have breath, we must keep challenging ourselves. Definitely.
100%. And I think it's quite clear that versatility has been kind of key to your success, really. I mean, you've worked on lots of high profile cases, doping, complex frauds. But my biggest question is, I've always wanted to know, how do you prepare for such a challenging case? And what do you say the key skills are that more of a defense barrister would need in these high stakes situations?
You've got to be organized. You've got to be able to obviously assimilate information quickly. You've got to be able to have what we call a case theory. So once you work out what your case is, then you can build your presentation and your organization around that, and your preparation, key preparation. You've got to know your case. You've got to live the case, breathe the case, almost as if it's you. So whenever I prepare a case, I prepare the case as if it was me who's been charged.
Wow.
So I try to find every single angle to cover, because I want to think that anyone representing me would have thought about all the things that I'm thinking about. And so when you do it that way, you're in a far better shape when you get in that courtroom to represent someone. I remember one of my mentors always said to me, the key to any case is preparation, preparation, preparation. Because if you don't prepare properly, you can't present properly. If you don't prepare properly, you don't know where you're going with the case. And so that case management and preparation is key, as well as having the skills of being able to assimilate facts very, very quickly.
And when things, you know, get a bit challenging in the courtroom, you know, you're presented with a new piece of evidence or something that you need to take on very quickly, how do you develop your skills to suddenly just switch on and answer?
That comes with obviously years of experience. But one thing I learned, and I had one of the best mentors ever, and he said to me, when you get presented with something in court, even if it's something which you're expecting or not expecting, don't show emotion, because then you give the game away. So you might be presented with something which is a quite damning piece of evidence, and you think, oh no, but you don't show that externally. So you absorb it, you assimilate quickly how you want to deal with it, and then you articulate it, whether it be arguing against it or accepting it, or even saying, well, actually, it's to my benefit. This is something that benefits me, even if it's not. You never give the game away.
Oh, wise words.
Very, very wise words. And working internationally, as you've spoken about before, you've worked in the Turks and Caicos Islands. But what is the difference between practicing law in the UK and in a different kind of jurisdiction?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, strangely enough, I mean, I've only ever practiced in the Turks and Caicos Islands sort of professionally, and they very much mirror themselves on the UK. So in terms of practice, all the procedures are the same. They wear the wigs and the gowns, even though it's very hot, although the air conditioning does work in the courtrooms. But things are a much slower pace. They don't obviously have the volume of work that we have, as we do in the UK. But I would say there's very little difference, because they adhere to everything that we do, the courtroom etiquettes, the advocacy, the preparation for cases. And they also have a lot of lawyers from the UK practicing there anyway. So I would say the main thing is just the volume of work. It's not as busy as it is here, but it's still busy comparative to the size of the island.
I see. I wouldn't have thought that. I would have thought it'd be so much busier, maybe not having
so many courts or
much, you know, historical and structural support in that industry. But I mean,
to be their credit, I mean, certainly I can only speak for Turks and Caicos, and I've got some knowledge of the courts in Trinidad. They're established systems, and they have a lot of lawyers.
Wow.
Yeah. Everyone wants to be a lawyer.
Don't they all?
It's competitive everywhere, isn't it?
I blame seats for that. That's a different conversation for a different day. Okay, so I guess onto a bit of a more touching topic, you could say. Obviously, I keep on highlighting this. You've been in the game for a little while now, and so you've definitely seen a lot change in the industry over the years. This conversation is part of obviously a wider Black History Month conversation, and you know, our theme this year is reclaiming narratives. What do you feel, or how do you feel, should I say, about the current state of the, I guess, wider courtroom law industry in regards to kind of diversity and inclusion? And you know, there are many who are going to be wanting to start a career that you are, I was going to say come to the end of, but from what you said about doing a master's not too long ago, maybe you're still soaring. But you know, there are going to be many who are definitely looking to start that journey, and you know, a lot of us come from diverse backgrounds. How do you feel about the way that the industry that you have, you know, dominated for so long is reacting to that surge or that wave of diverse talent?
Well, you know, it's really it's really poignant that you asked me that question. Throughout the course of this month, I have posted a figure in history to celebrate Black History Month, because I'm a student of history. I love learning new things. Yesterday's post was about a guy called Christian Cole, who was the first Black barrister to practice in the courts in this country in 1874. Wow. He was the first Black man to go to Oxford. And every time I read his story, I'm inspired, not only because it shows that I stand on the shoulders of greatness, those who went before me, but it shows even then a guy like him who was in the minority, and I mean really the minority, he was undeterred and he made it. You know, he went to Oxford, he practiced law, he was a member of the Inner Temple, and there have been others after him. And so to your question about diversity, we are more diverse than ever. Even when I started in the early 90s, you could literally count in our little circle the number of Black barristers. We all knew each other. We still do. Some of us, you know, to this day, we remain friends after 30 plus years. But I'm more encouraged than ever when I look around at certain events that I go to see the number of different faces from the norm, I will say, who are entering the profession. I went to an event, I was a speaker at an event last year called the Black Council Forum, And I remember walking into this room and just seeing a sea of black lawyers in the corporate field, in criminal law, employment, copyright, all sorts of areas were covered by these lawyers of various disciplines and abilities. And I thought, wow, we're making progress. And so for me, the future looks bright, because when I look at the practice that I'm in, it's more diverse than ever. We still have issues. So we have a lack of black judges at the very senior positions, very few. But I know the next generation are going to fill the gap, because although some of us didn't make it to the judiciary yet, the next generation will fill that gap. So the future's bright.
I love that. I love the word yet. If there's one word,
that caveat there.
Yeah. If there's one word, I mean, obviously, I love the whole answer. Yeah. But if there's one word I really love from that answer, it's the word yet, because, you know, you're not done.
No, certainly not.
And if you're not done, how possibly could we be done that we're just starting?
Absolutely.
So I absolutely love that.
No, that's brilliant. And I'd also like to say, do you think that with the judiciary the way it is at the moment, and obviously the amount of time it takes to become a member of it, do you think that in the future we will start seeing this wave of diversity and inclusion through the judiciary as well?
Yeah, because actually you can apply for judicial appointment. I think it's somewhere between after 10 years, I want to say 10 years, it might even be 7. Mm. So you've got some very young judges who are making it through, who've decided they don't want to practice anymore, but they want to become judges. And I think as we move forward, diversity means that they're going to be a lot more young black judges who decide that they want a place on the bench. Mm. So yeah, I mean, as I say, I have every confidence that things will be a lot different in 5 to 10 years time. And I know there's an active drive to encourage people from diverse backgrounds to apply, because they're conscious, the judiciary are conscious of the lack of diversity at the top end in terms of the judiciary.
No, for certain.
Do you think you may be joining?
Or I'm not saying anything.
You're not saying anything. Jury sell out on that
we
one.
We shall see.
Tune in on the next. Well, this is the last episode of the series.
We shall see.
I like that. I like that. So I guess, obviously, it's really important to highlight the work you've done with the British Nigeria Law Forum, building, you know, legal communities across nations. And I guess my question would be, what has been the most impactful outcome of these, like, collaborations? I'm from Ghanaian descent, and it has always been my dream. Obviously, law is not my passion, politics is, but it's always been my dream to eventually go back home and try and reform politics back home. That's a different conversation for a different day. But, like, I just love to hear more about kind of the work you've done bridging those barriers and kind of bridging those gaps.
Yeah, so when I became chair of the BNLF, the British Nigerian Law Forum, it was at a difficult stage in its organization. We lost a bit of direction, but we were doing some great things and had done some great things and wanted to continue. And we recognized that Nigerian lawyers didn't necessarily know who their counterparts were in the UK. There was a lot of cross-border work that required collaboration between the two groups. There were lawyers in the UK who wanted to go and perhaps go and do the Nigerian exams. And so we wanted to liaise with the Nigerian Bar Association regarding that possibility. And it was just really an opportunity to say, look, we're here, you're there. As the Nigerians say, we should know ourselves. You know, we should know ourselves. So it was just an opportunity to recognize each other and to have a network, a framework that people could tap into for various legal problems, and really just showcase excellence. And I'm glad to see that the BNLF has continued and continues to grow and thrive. We do that through networking opportunities, trips to Nigeria, education and training. I've done some work with some of the judiciary there on sentencing and criminal law. And I know some of my colleagues in the commercial law field have done the same. And so the work continues. In fact, there's a gala dinner coming up in the next couple of weeks for the British Nigerian Lawyers Forum.
We'll be waiting for our invites, of course.
Well, they'll invite you, but they'll charge you a lot for a table. So
as long as I can fork out the money.
You can pay to play. but it's a great opportunity to meet your counterparts from overseas in Nigeria, and also to meet your colleagues here who you don't necessarily know, because everybody's so busy that sometimes you don't know each other, and it's a great opportunity.
Thank you.
No, that's brilliant. And we already know you've worked on international arbitration cases, criminal cases, sports, but compared to the traditional court proceedings that you're used to, what unique challenges do those kind of cases come with?
Well, the sports arbitration cases that I've been involved in, it's a different skill because, as I say, you're not before a judge and jury. You're before a panel of arbitrators, and it's a different setting from the courtroom with the drama of a jury trial. And so you have to remember that when you're representing a particular individual, as you often are, who's been accused of breaking some regulation in sports through doping or taking illicit substances. So it's a different kind of skill, and you know that your audience is different when you're addressing them and what you're seeking to persuade them of. It's not that adversarial prosecution, defense, jury, proof beyond reasonable doubt, the criminal standard and all of that, burden of standard of proof. It's none of that. It's actually presenting your case, a persuasive case that allows the tribunal to decide one way or the other, on a balance of probabilities, if you like, that your case is true, or that your client actually deserves the benefit of the doubt through testing of medical evidence, hearing of medical evidence, and hearing them give evidence. Whereas with the criminal trial, you're at it with the prosecution, you're locking horns on every point, and you're trying to persuade not the judge of what's true, but a jury of your peers, 12 people who don't know your client, and then making a closing speech.
It's all right, I think. Are you okay?
Yeah.
Something's all right.
Yeah, it was all right.
You okay?
Yeah. No, you're good.
What do we do?
It was you. I blame you.
Involved. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We'll okay.
Will they do all the editing? Will they?
Yeah. No.
Okay.
Fine. Brilliant.
Should we carry on?
Yeah, we can carry on.
So that's the main difference. Because of my journey now into arbitration, I'm just feeling and developing into sort of the international arbitration world. It's something which is quite new to me. But what I have learned is, contrary to what I felt before, a lot of the skills that I've acquired over the years actually are useful in this different arena. And so I always tell people, listen, don't think that at any stage of your career that you want to go and do something else, that all you've done in the past is wasteful. It's not. You're actually using skills that you've acquired over all these years to employ them in something slightly different, in a different way, but nonetheless they're useful.
No, I can imagine. Does that, having that inside knowledge, does that give you a little bit of a changed mindset when you see these articles come up, these cases come up in the news and in other departments?
Yeah, because and you know, you analyze things in a different way, you do so with an insight into how generally law works, because law is law. It's just applied in a different way in different fields, but at the heart of it, you know, certainly for me, is advocacy. That's what we do. You know, we talk, we speak, we argue. And so once you have those that advocacy skill, you can employ it in different ways, whether it's before an arbitration panel or tribunal, or whether it's in a public hearing. At the core of what we do is advocacy.
It's like a set of tools, almost.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Use them.
Yeah.
Use them how you like.
Absolutely.
Words of wisdom over there. But before we wrap up, just wanted to ask, as we kind of reflect on your career and you know, what legacy do you think you've already left, and what do you hope to leave going forward, especially for mentoring the next generation?
I love that question.
Wow. You know, I did a case a few years ago, which gave birth to my sort of social enterprise, life in focus, life of focus. They're interchangeable. But I remember with this young man who was found not guilty of murder, and I'd spent weeks with him, so I got to know him. He didn't really have a father figure in his life, and he said, when he was found not guilty, he hugged me. He said, "Sir, you're like a father to me," because I'd spent so long with him. And I said, "Son, I want you to go and live a full and productive life. You need to live a life of focus." And that's where this was all born out of, the mentoring, and wanting to empower young kids to say, look, make the right choices. You know, if you tap into what you're focused in about or passionate about, there's a way forward for you. And in terms of legacy, that's all I've ever wanted it to be, inspiring the next generation, not necessarily of lawyers, but inspiring young people to be their very best. Because I always regularly tell my colleagues, you know, with all that I think I have achieved, or other people have told me that I've achieved, my time on the stage is limited, as is everybody's. So why not work on leaving a legacy as you go along? Because sometimes you're going to have to exit left or right,
of course,
and prepare it for the next person coming behind you.
Absolutely.
So your analogy, as I climb the ladder, it's not pulling the ladder up behind me, it's helping the next person up behind me.
Lift as you climb.
Absolutely. And that's what it's all about.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sorry, that's just...
It was really inspiring.
Yeah, it just got really me, got me in a bit of a trance. But honestly, thank you so much for your words and to hear, you know, just a very brief snippet of your story and the impact you've had. And I'm sure you will continue to, you know, create impact and leave a strong legacy behind and really build for generations to come. And, you know, I just hope to be there and watch it all.
Front and center audience.
Literally.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure, Stephen.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap on series one. Thank you to all of our guests and to everyone that's tuned in along the way.
Brilliant. Thanks, everyone. See you.
Bye.